Hello, Pacific Palisades. Welcome to the Pali Podcast Edition, March 19th. We're thrilled to have you all with us again. And today, our illustrious guest is no other than Assemblymember Richard Bloom. But before we introduce him and get going with the conversation that we're going to have with him for the next hour, how's it going, Steve Crone?
Things are going well. We're getting by. Things are starting to turn around, I think. And glad to be here every month at Village Studios. For those of you that have not had a chance to come, I know this was Richard's first visit. It's an amazing place, and we're really grateful to be able to use the studio every month.
One of these days, we really are going to upload pictures from this beautiful historic place. The room we're in now really deserves to be in pictures. It's kind of dimly lit, definitely from a different era, kind of lyrical to just be in here.
So. They call this one the Moroccan Room.
Yep, we'll have to post pictures. Can't get away from it this time. We've promised for a year we'll post pictures, so we got to get there.
One of these days. Richard, glad to have you here. Richard Bloom is a friend of both Miriam and myself. He has been our assemblyman or assembly person since 2012, and he's done a bang-up job. In some ways, we're sorry to hear that Richard has decided to run for the Board of Supervisors, so he may no longer be our assembly person starting in 2012. But for now, we're happy to have him, and Richard, really happy to have you with us today.
It's great to be here, Steve. This room, and Miriam, this room is absolutely stunning. I was telling Steve before we started that when I was in law school, I lived about two blocks away, and I walked by this place. I knew what was going on inside. I knew the artists who were recording here, and the great broken freeway mural that's outside was brand new at that time, and they're talking about restoring it, which would be fantastic because it is stunning when it's freshly painted.
Yeah, I would say in walking through the hallways here, I can't think of a famous rock and roll band that hasn't recorded here. The Rolling Stones, Fleetwood Mac, and Lady Gaga, and on and on and on. And it feels historic to be here every month.
Yeah, as a music fan, and who isn't in this town? I certainly am. It just there's a chill in my spine that just is invigorating.
It's an iconic place. But I have to ask you, what year was that that you lived down the road and kind of knew what was
that
happening?
That would have been, let's just get right into the, that would have been 76 to 78.
All right,
I graduated in 78.
Steve, I'm going to make you hearken back to all that you know about music. What was going on in 76? Like, what was the big band? It was, what, Fleetwood Mac was recording in here?
Whoa, I know they recorded a whole album here. I have no clue who was popular back then.
How cool to think that you were walking by and those guys were in here making music.
Yeah.
So
and still are.
Yeah.
It still are, absolutely. It's an active studio. There's about five or six separate rooms, and they record all the time. I was here last Christmas, and I walked in, and there was a bottle of wine with a card on it for Robbie Robertson from the band, and he had been recording there, and so the host, the owner, had a bottle of wine waiting for him. Every time I'm here, there's always news of somebody else famous at Village Studios, so we're glad to be here.
So, Assemblymember Bloom.
Yes.
How's it going up in Sacramento these days? It must be very different. Must have been an incredibly different year. And for all the issues that I know you guys are grappling with, and there are many we're going to ask you about, give us a sense of what State Assembly has been like for the last year. Have you guys been meeting? How has it been? And then I know there are a lot of issues, but I just want to touch on education. The state has a lot of say in education, and education around here has been upended.
Yeah, it's a big issue. The learning loss is something that we're going to be living with for a long time, and it's going to take a lot of work to get kids back up to speed. But Sacramento, it's its own kind of weirdness. I think every business, every institution, every part of life has been upended by the pandemic, and Sacramento is no different. So literally a year ago, I think it was a year ago today, we recessed for several weeks didn't have any hearings at all. We were in the middle of moving forward our bills and in the middle of the budget process, and all of a sudden, pandemic is here, lockdown is happening. We were all sent home. And so things slowed down to a crawl, and the budget process was very truncated. You may know that I chair one of the budget subcommittees. And so we were in the middle of our hearing process and weren't able to provide the level of oversight on the budget that we normally do.
And did you know by then that this budget was going to take a hit? I mean, had it become obvious to assembly members and state senators that we were heading into some dire straits economically?
Yes, but we expected that to hit us this year, because if you think about it, the prior year had been a great year in California. We were really thriving and doing well. So revenue from various sources was expected and was at a decent level. We were fortunate that we had a rainy day fund that was at that point fully funded. We had budget surpluses for the prior few years. So we were in pretty good shape at that moment, but we immediately started thinking about what's this going to mean for the future, because when business shut down, that means we don't get the revenue right in the following tax year.
So for people who don't know, tell us where the Assembly is in the annual process of bills or you know, your cycle in March. How far away are you from concluding things? Where are bills? They're still being debated, probably amended.
Sure. Most of the budget is put to bed before the end of June. In fact, that's in the state constitution, and we don't get paid if we don't finish the budget process at that time. And so we're highly motivated to make sure that that happens. And fortunately, every year that that I've been in the Assembly, we've been able to deliver the budget on time. But we're more or less in the middle of that process now, you know, kind of where we dropped off a year ago. And we have our challenges now because we're doing social distancing just like everybody else. And the committee rooms, the floor of the legislature only holds so many people when you're 6 feet apart from one another. So our committee process has been very different. We allow a limited number of people into the Capitol, a limited number of people into committee rooms, and if you want to testify publicly, you can try to get into the committee room, but your best bet is to do it by telephone. So at the end of my hearings, when we do public comment, most of the people are calling in. There's a operator who's out in space somewhere. It's a disembodied voice who says, "Next caller, you're on line 13. You know, press star 80, and you know you're able to make your minute or two of public comment." So that's very different.
Different, yeah.
Because normally we have people, as we should, who come into the hearing room, they look you in the eye and testify.
So yeah. Along that line, I understand that things are different in a big way because of COVID. Are things different because of what happened in the Capitol, the United States Capitol, on January 6th? I mean, is security ramped up in Sacramento as well?
Yes, security remains high. There are more, it's mostly CHP officers who provide us with our security. There are more than the norm from a year ago, if you will. But in the aftermath of what happened in Washington and while that was going on, and even before that, because there were demonstrations, Black Lives Matter demonstrations in the prior months in Sacramento that focused on the Capitol, there were times when there were CHP and other law enforcement agencies that were virtually shoulder to shoulder guarding the Capitol.
And so I assume people go through a metal detector when they go into the Capitol nowadays?
That's correct. That's longstanding.
How about members of the Assembly and the Senate? Do you have to go through metal detectors as well?
We're not required to go through metal detectors, but there are security at all of the entrance points. We're recognizable faces to security. So
That would make sense, but I'm thinking about what's happened in D.C. where some Congress people are saying, I'm bringing my gun in and you can't stop me. And I wonder if you have anything like that in Sacramento.
We have not gotten to that point in Sacramento, and I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, Richard, I was going to say, I mean, obviously the California legislature is largely Democratic, but you have Republican colleagues, and it doesn't seem like California mimics national politics right now at the state level. You also, everybody seems to have a little bit more congeniality. I mean, I see so many committees where there are Republicans and Democrats working together. Is that something you guys are aware of?
Yeah, I think it's true. I think there's more collegiality in Sacramento than at least what we perceive there to be in D.C. Because, you know, what we know about D.C. Is what we see on the news, what we hear. You know, when you tend to hear about the controversies and the most controversial and sometimes the most caustic remarks, and I think that can color our perception to some degree. One thing we know is that things are almost evenly divided in D.C., and I think that that brings its own conflict with it. We don't have all of those problems or a lot of those problems in Sacramento because, you know, frankly, Democrats control both houses of the legislature and the administration.
Yeah. Do you have any?
It's worked out well, in my opinion.
Do you have any idea? And it's purely theoretical, what would happen if the numbers of Democrats and Republicans were equal in Sacramento, whether that would give rise to some more right-wing fanaticism, which might rear its ugly head in Sacramento as well?
Well, I think there would be less of that in California because, generally speaking, in California, people are either moderate or leaning to the left. I mean, many Republicans in California lean to very closely to the center. We see crossover votes all the time on bills in Sacramento, where that's a rarity in Washington, D.C.
Well, you know what they say, as California goes, so goes the nation. I was recently talking to someone who's in media, and interesting that you say, Assemblymember Bloom, about the way that we perceive national politics because we pretty much get it from national news. But this person who works in media was saying, you know, you get what's controversial because that's what brings up the ratings. So you get the hyperbole, and then, you know, people who aren't necessarily versed in politics or getting news from other sources assume that everything is very polarized, and so people become polarized, you know, as kind of a mimicking of what they see going on in D.C. And so I wonder if people were to seek, we can move on, but I mean, you were a moderator before you became a politician, you were in family law, so those skills probably come in handy. Wonder if, you know, if people were to get their news more from local sources than national sources, would we perceive things differently?
I think that would cause a change in perception, but also we tend to just hear top-line news. You know, it's a very small fraction of the whole story. It's very difficult in 2 to 3 minutes or the length of most news stories to really go in-depth. And the exceptions to that are shows like 60 Minutes or NPR News, which tends to go in depth into issues. But it also depends on what you're watching. So if you're watching NPR, I think you're getting more of a even-handed approach to providing news. If you're watching Fox, well, that's something radically different. And you also... on Fox and frankly on CNN and many of the other outlets, they are focused on conflict, very much focused on conflict, and that then tends to replicate itself in the general population. It's very corrosive, in my opinion, to our democracy.
But it drives ratings. And if they sat on the sideline and talked about, you know, this bill passed or didn't pass, and don't get into the the weeds about who's screaming and yelling and outrageous.
Especially if you say it like that, Steve.
Well, that's the way I perceive it. They want to know all the drama and all the arguing and all the name calling, because that drives ratings, I think.
You know, yes and no. Steve, you and I grew up at a time when Walter Cronkite, for example, and he was only one example, was one of the most respected names out there. And he was able to provide a fairly even-handed summary of news every night that people respected and didn't cause people to fight.
True.
And the ratings for that show were high.
Well as Huntley Brinkley, same sort of thing.
Yeah. All those great newscasters that made me in college want to be a journalist. And so for a short period of time, I was a journalism major. That was my ticket to transferring from UCLA to Cal.
Honestly, I think politics and journalism often go hand in hand. I was moderating a discussion with consuls general, and something that they all had in common was a past in journalism. So I was just going to ask you, what took you into politics? And now I know there's journalism in there. I thought it was just law. What was the issue that compelled you to pay attention?
Can we go back a little further? Can we go back? I know you went to Fairfax High.
I did.
You grew up somewhere in the west side of Los Angeles.
No. I grew up, I was born in Philadelphia. My family was living in Camden, New Jersey at the time, which particularly at that time was generally considered not the best city to live in. And so I'm pretty sure my mom chose the hospital in Philly, just so I'd be able to say I was from Philadelphia and not Camden. But I was born in Philadelphia. When I was three, the family moved to Altadena in the San Gabriel Valley. My dad, who was an aeronautical engineer, the first in his family, the first in our family, to go to college at Boston University, took a job in a little postage stamp of a town, Sierra Madre.
In the foothills of the San Gabriel.
Nestled into the foothills, exactly.
Yeah, sure.
Beautiful hiking above. I worked at the manufacturing plant there for a couple of summers and learned about a lot of the people who lived in that area. A lot of them lived up in cabins in the woods above the town that are now very fancy homes. That was a great place to live, and during the course of the time that I was growing up until we left in the eighth grade and moved to West L.A. to get to West L.A., Steve. But I saw, before I left, I saw two, maybe three major forest fires literally erupt. It almost seemed like it was in our backyard because we were that close to the foothills. And I think that was, no pun intended, one of the sparks that later on in life got me interested in environmental issues. Also, the ability to hike in those canyons and see wildlife, I think, had a big impression on me.
And you really lead on environmental issues in Sacramento, don't you?
I mean, I try to.
Of the issues that you definitely take the lead on. So, about Camden, I grew up in Livingston, New Jersey, not far.
You then went on to law school and you practiced family law for many years, right?
Yes,
and then,
over 30. Seems impossible at this point. But
I think I've got over 45 years of, and then you ran for Santa Monica City Council at some point.
Yes.
Right? And yes. Served there for, 12, 13 years?
Yep. I ran in 1996 and got my butt kicked. Didn't have a successful run at all. But what I learned is what I didn't have was a coalition of people and endorsers and organizations supporting me. So I came back in 1998, 2 years later, and ran again. Picked up a lot of endorsements and support. On election eve, I was down the entire evening by a very small margin. The last precinct came in at midnight, some, you know, late hour, and I went up by 100 votes. Yeah, and then some people took me aside and they said, you know, Richard, enjoy this feeling, but they're now going to count the absentee ballots and the late absentees and the provisional ballots, and those usually come in the way the early votes, the early absentees come in, and we predict you're going to lose. And I'm like, are you guys kidding me? I just went over the top. Sure enough, I lost that election by, it was a heartbreaker, by 100 votes. There was a resignation on the council a short time later, and that was when in 1999, that's when I was able to take a seat on the council.
So that was your
first, never looked back.
That was your first foray into politics. Do you recall what it was that made you jump in?
I had a couple of offices in middle school and high school.
Okay.
Well, no, in 96, when you had no one, when it was just Richard Blum running, what was the big issue at the time in Santa Monica?
Same issues as now. Poll people, the order has changed. I think homelessness was one of the top three issues.
Wow.
Still is, but it's number one now.
Was development or building?
Parking and traffic. Yeah.
Interesting. And then you lost by 100 votes, 100 singular votes?
Roughly.
So was population lower? Was there less participation? I mean, that does not seem like a determinative number of votes. I mean, of course, I know you can win or lose on three or four, but 100.
Every vote counts. No, I learned that lesson well. Why would you remember my race in 2012? That was a close one, too.
Of course we remember your race in 2012.
I remember it because that's when you and I met.
How close was that?
Well, on election eve, I was up by between 100 and 200 votes. And so I thought, oh, my God, is history repeating itself?
No.
As I recall, it went up, then it went down, but it was not until... right before Thanksgiving, the vote plurality went down to 60 or 70 votes. I was only ahead by that much. And then the holiday was over, and at that point, it went straight up in my favor, and I won by about 1,700 votes or so. Still a close election. People ask me what I think happened because it was kind of dramatic the way it went up at the end. And that's when they counted the provisional ballots. That was 2012 when Obama ran in his second term. If you remember, there was an emphasis on getting young college kids to sign up and vote. Very successful campaign. So there were a lot of new voters, and my version of what happened is that all those kids didn't know where to vote. They went to the wrong precinct, so they were all provisional ballots, and they favored me because they recognized my ballot designation was mayor of Santa Monica, and these young kids said, I like that town. I partied there last week. I went to a bar there last week. He can't be all bad. I'll vote for him.
This is your strategic read on your win.
I think, I, you know, frankly, it can be things like that that can turn an election one way or the other. And it's why I even those who disagree with me or with whom I disagree, I try to pay attention to every voter.
You have often, since this is the Pally podcast, you've often talked about...
Love the Palisades.
Exactly. You've often talked about the impact of the Palisades on that first race.
Yep.
You had a huge ground game here. You really resonated, I think, in the Palisades. Tell us a little bit, the Palisades loomed large for you in that race. How'd that come about?
You know, some people think of the Palisades as a neighborhood of Santa Monica. I know the place is different because I've lived here so long, and I know that the people pay very close attention to politics. Everybody votes, not some people, everybody votes in the Palisades. So we knew that that had the potential beyond Santa Monica to be a strong base for me. Plus, it was very familiar to me. Really, the whole West Side, this district couldn't have been carved out better for me because I've spent so many years in various parts of it. I grew up in Carthay Circle around Olympic and La Cienega once we had moved out here from the San Gabriel Valley. Went to Fairfax, another touchstone in the district. And there's many, many others. You know, depending on where I am in the district, I can talk about, for example, in the Miracle Mile, how my mom used to drive it. My mom and dad used to drive in every Sunday. We were a kosher family. And we would go to Loeb's Butcher Shop in the Miracle Mile and the bakery, Sabovic's Bakery on Pico near Robertson. And, you know, so these are all places that some people recognize the stores to this day. Where I was? Oh, we're in the Palisades. So the Pacific Palisades was a place where I knew I could knock on doors and hopefully resonate. And I knocked on a lot of doors in the Palisades.
And
I think it's true about Palisadians. They have issues. They know the issues. If you knock on a door and you want to talk about something, they'll know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and I heard about them. But what people remembered is that I took the time to knock on the door, and that made a big difference.
And you had the Pacific Palisades Democratic Club.
I did.
Working for you tirelessly, as they have been known to do for many a candidate, many a successful candidate.
Steve Krohn, were you the president at the time?
I met you. I don't know if you remember where we met. You were mayor and you were running, and Joe Halper, who was a mentor of yours and is a mentor of mine, said, you guys ought to get together. And we went and had a bite to eat in the Santa Monica Place, and you were telling me about how you were running. And, you know, I asked for my support, and, you know, I did. I gave, you know, a few pennies here and there, but have been supporting you ever since.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've done a marvelous job in every way that a Democrat would represent this district. And I say this with respect, but I also say that I think any Democrat who is successful in this area would have similar politics to yours, right? I can't imagine you're going to have somebody who's going to be really conservative or real radical in this area. You're going to be what we used to call a liberal Democrat, right?
But Assemblymember Bloom, this district is weird, is it not? You know better than anyone else.
This district is wonderful. I would never call it weird.
Okay, disparate.
What do you mean by weird, Miriam?
Just boundaries. That's it, just boundaries. No, but I mean, all the way up to Agoura Hills, you know, and then all the way in, I'm sure there are parts of the district that have very little in common.
So, yeah, the redistricting, you know, creates some strange lines sometimes. And the odd ones in AD 50 are that Westwood is kind of carved out from the district all the way up through UCLA, which bothers me a little bit since I went to school there. But the school's had great representation from others. And as I already said, most of the student body comes and spends time in Santa Monica anyway and in the district. The other part of the district that is, most of the district ends at Mulholland Drive, except Agoura Hills, where I go over into the Conejo Valley. It's a great fit for the district and for the Palisades. There's a lot of consistency of interests, very environmentally aware, very concerned about local issues. So there's a lot of similarity, a lot of things that ties it all together.
Let me throw out an area that is of enormous concern in the Palisades, and that's fire safety.
Yeah.
I know we've talked about that. You've spoken at the Palisades Democratic Club and many venues. Is there anything new that's happening in Sacramento as far as that, as far as funding, as far as getting new equipment, things that make it less likely that we'd have another catastrophic fire in your district?
Well, this is not breaking news I say that every year since I was elected in 2012 has been successively a worst case year in fire. It's increased every year until it reached a crescendo last year. I think it was 4 million acres throughout the state burned. And the prediction for the coming year is that it's going to be a bad year as well. So this is an extremely important issue. We spend justifiably an enormous amount of money on firefighting, on fighting fires. But what we have not done a good job on is prevention. And when we think about prevention, it's everything from home hardening to making sure there's defensible space around homes to fire breaks in the forests. It can mean doing what they call controlled burns. That's a great concern down here because we aren't in a woodland forest area. We are in an area of chaparral, and different strategies are appropriately employed. So we've never really put a substantial amount of money into this. I held a hearing, one of my budget hearings, an informational hearing, in the fall around this very topic. We heard from a number of experts. And this year, for the first time ever, last year we spent $70 million on prevention efforts, $70 million. This year, the governor has proposed $1 billion. We're actually working on trying to do some of that in what we call early action so that we push the money out now. Normally, the June budget kicks in January of the following year. So if we can kick that money out now, we can actually do some good for the coming fire season.
$70 million seems paltry.
It is paltry. And yet much more is needed. So we really need to just continuously look at this.
It's clear, unless you've got your head in the sand, that climate change is happening and it's getting hotter and drier every year. Can technology and money and new equipment keep up with that to at least keep it in check? Or is it just a losing battle that...
No,
we're never going to win.
No. You're putting your finger on an important issue, and we've been buying over the last several years a lot of updated technology, lasers that pinpoint where fires start and allow us to get fire services there quickly. We now pre-position units all over the state, depending on where we anticipate the hotspots to be. There's a lot of science that goes. They use satellite technology. Weather technology has improved over the last 20 years to where weather events are highly predictable today. So we know when the heat waves are going to hit and so forth. You might be surprised to know that when I came into the legislature in 2012 and I was given my budget subcommittee assignment immediately by then Speaker John Perez, who had spent about $1 million to try and defeat me in that 2012 race, and then welcomed me with open arms. We're very good friends today. Speaker Perez thought I would be a good fit for this budget subcommittee, and I think it's worked out really well. I feel good about the time that I've spent on the committee. But at that time, our fleet of helicopters around the state, the CAL FIRE helicopters, were all Vietnam-era helicopters that had been retrofitted to fight fires. There were, I think at that time, two spare engines left. Saying that the helicopters were held together by baling wire and duct tape is not a terrible exaggeration. They were safe, but we needed to revamp that fleet, and that's something that I have prioritized, and we're now in the process of completely updating, well into the process of updating the fleet of helicopters. Just another example. By the way, the Vietnam-era helicopters couldn't fly at night.
Wow.
The new fleet of helicopters can fly day and night. They're much more maneuverable, and the capabilities are far superior.
So can all the new technology and equipment balance out the increased heat and the dryness that leads to forest fires,
well,
and catastrophic fires?
The climate crisis is a mighty foe, and that's really what we're battling here. And we haven't been doing a very good job of it up until now. This prevention piece is extremely important because it represents, unfortunately, it represents adaptation to current day conditions. But adaptation is something that we have to do because we've been done such a poor job of rising to the challenge.
Yeah, we've been behind the curve for a while.
We definitely have.
I definitely want to shift our focus over to what some of the important issues are going to be at the county level, because you're going to be talking about them soon. But just quickly, you know, I noticed a couple of years ago that there are bills going through the California legislature that have to do with fire. And obviously, like Steve says, we can't change the way the sun shines or, you know, well, we can't immediately change how climate impacts fire. But obviously, there are tools at our fingertips that we can use to, I guess, prepare or deal with it better. Do these bills get traction across the entire state? I mean, are there lawmakers who look at them and say, well, you know, what are you going to do? We're going to pour some money in here and we're still going to have fires? Or is this an issue that's getting traction? People are alarmed about it and we're moving ahead in some way.
Well, I think the answer is yes. And that has increased dramatically with the dramatic increase in fires that we've seen. And so just like the fires reached a crescendo, I think the place in the hierarchy of issues of fire and fire prevention have
and it's clearly, bipartisan.
Yes, I mean we've lost so many lives. The Paradise fire a couple of years ago was a wake-up call. I think just a dramatic tragedy that slapped us all in the face and made us all the more woken up about this issue.
Yeah, all the more alert. So when you look over at the county level, are there issues that you've had experience with at the state level that you think you can bring over? Are there new issues that, you know, you're sort of working to get up to speed on? What's the big shift?
Definitely. Well, you know, I've built my reputation on environmental issues, on housing issues, on animal welfare and protecting wildlife. All of those issues are very important at the county level, too, and I would expect to hopefully continue my leadership on those issues. Homelessness is something that I've focused on. All of these issues go back to my time in local government, and the county is, given its size, it's kind of a hybrid of the state and local government. The issues are enormous. The population base of the county is 10 million people. There's five supervisors, so we each represent 2 million people, the size of a small state.
Yeah.
It's huge. Fire issues abound in the county. The county has its own fire department. And so I think many of the lessons and the things that I've worked on in Sacramento will translate quite well. I want to do more work on homelessness. I want to provide more leadership, as I did when I was the mayor of Santa Monica, on that issue. It saddens me that to no end that homelessness has increased over the past many years, in spite of our, I was going to say our best efforts, and I think our best efforts are yet to come. Mm-hmm. There's more attention and funding and more public attention on homelessness today than ever before. So I really think we need to be committing to a new paradigm in the way we address that issue.
Before you move away from housing and homelessness, I just want to say quickly, so homelessness, I feel like, is an issue that's more local, right? So when you look at it from the state level, there might be less that you can do to impact it, whereas when you come down to the county level, especially given the budget that there is now for homelessness, you definitely will have more that you can do, more tools that you can use to impact homelessness. Housing is a little bit of a hybrid, right? Because
yes.
Even up at the state level, you're looking at state bills, you know, that mandate certain housing density bills or issues that impact local governments. And there's some friction there, right?
There is.
Because at the local level, people want some control. You're in this unique position where you've seen both. You can sense both of those instincts. What do you think? How do you think you're going to manage that over at the county level?
I really can, and I'll, it surprises many people. My start in politics was, when it really got serious, was as the president of a local neighborhood organization in Santa Monica. And that was a time in which I was really able to become much more aware of a variety of issues that were affecting the city of Santa Monica, but also was a time when people in political circles, if you will, started to take notice of the work that I was doing and talk to me at city council meetings and things like that. And I was, and eventually it was suggested that, well, Richard, maybe you should run for city council. And I was like, but that was where I first really became aware of homelessness. And when I started running, Santa Monica is generally respected as a very progressive city, a city that cares about people, and on homelessness as a leader. When I was running in 1996 or 1998, I forget which election it was, one of my mentors, a great council member and mayor, Ken Genser, and I were at a forum. And somebody asked a question about homelessness, and I got up and I said, well, you know, ladies and gentlemen, homeless people are our brothers and our sisters. And I had barely gotten that sentence out of my mouth when people started booing and hissing. And I was taken aback. I didn't recognize where I was, but I realized that people were upset about homelessness. And so when I finally won that election in 99, I decided to prioritize it. And nobody really wanted to, I wouldn't say nobody was paying attention to it, but nobody wanted to take it on as a priority because, frankly, this is not an issue that's a political winner for anybody.
No, but those people are going to care when there's homeless people camping in their front yard.
And they do.
Then it's going to become an important issue for them.
And so at that time, I started learning about best practices, and we did in fact bring a number of best practices. We involved the community on a deeper level than they'd been involved before. The business community was given a role to play in helping solve homeless issues. And that was really very helpful for everybody, but most importantly, for the people who are experiencing homelessness in and around Santa Monica. Those experiences were very instructive for me, and I want to bring, it's not that I haven't done anything on homelessness in Sacramento, I have, but I've been particularly focused on housing, and homelessness is at its baseline level is a housing issue. It is complicated by substance abuse. It's complicated by mental illness. It can be complicated by the reason one becomes homeless. Mental illness. It could be substance abuse. It could be domestic violence at home. It could be a child who, a child who runs away from home and might be running away from domestic violence or a bad situation at home.
Homelessness is also an issue that is complicated by housing policies and development policies And again, I'll let you move away from it if you want, but again, I feel like you are one of those unique lawmakers who's had the local city experience and you've had the state experience. And you know that the state, you know, has an urgency to say, hey, cities, move quicker on homelessness. But you also know that down on the city's level, there is some control people want to have, you know, the authenticity of neighborhoods, the texture of the neighborhoods that create Los Angeles. You know, local people want to grow in their own way, in their own pace, with their own signature. How are you going to bridge that divide, especially given that you're going to be a county, you're going to have a budget for homelessness and housing? I mean, it'll be inescapable.
It can be tough to thread that needle. And the bottom line is we are millions of housing units short in the state of California. This is the housing affordability crisis is a crisis that really affects everyone, with the exception of the very wealthy, you know, those who can afford to live most anywhere, not necessarily everywhere, but most everywhere. You know, my children who are millennials who, you know, both work, it's extremely expensive for them to find affordable housing. Working class people, teachers, and on down the line, affordability is at crisis levels. Many people are spending 50%, Californians are spending 50% or more of their income on housing costs. And that is causing a diminution in quality of life for nearly everybody in the state, the majority of the population. The people for whom it's worst are people at the lower ends of the economic scale. And for those people, the next step is frequently homelessness. And one of the things that we see in California, but particularly here in the city of LA and the 88 cities of the county of Los Angeles, is that we actually are housing record numbers of people who are experiencing homelessness. But on a monthly basis, more people are entering homelessness than are leaving homelessness.
Yeah.
And so that statistic is why we see more and more people on the street today. It's tragic. And it doesn't all relate to housing, but much of it relates to this pressure on the limited housing stock that we have. So we've poured billions of dollars between the county and the city of Los Angeles and the state of California in funding for deed-restricted affordable housing. But it's not enough because it's costing between $500,000 and $600,000 a door to build a unit of affordable housing today. So it's very expensive, and we need to be creative about where we build our housing. One of the most it's wonderful and it's sad at the same time. I've become relatively well known for my legislation that has facilitated the construction of accessory dwelling units, ADUs, backyard granny flats, as they're frequently called. Los Angeles now, I think, has City of LA, I think, permitted or constructed 16,000 of them. And across the state, they're booming. They're no pun intended, a cottage industry of companies that that will, you know, build these things for you. And people love them. People in neighborhoods love them.
And that has an impact on housing density.
It does, but we could talk in more detail about the fact that, for example, most cities already had ADU laws allowing people to build them. But over the years, it had become more and more difficult to build them because of local regulation that you have to have a certain setback, you can't tandem park, very, very restrictive ordinances that made it difficult, if not impossible, to build them. That's what my reform and the bills of others changed. This is being touted as one of the most important and most productive changes in housing legislation in recent years. And the number of units that have been built are in the tens and twenties of thousands when we need 1.6 million units. And so it's been a big success, but it's kind of a sad commentary on where we are in housing also.
I don't want to get into the weeds on housing, but yeah, I mean, there's creative housing that helps what you were talking about, which is that stream of people coming into homelessness. And then there's that very expensive permanent supportive housing that has to get done for people who are already homeless. And if we could find a balance, I think we could start to, impact homelessness. But we're going to move on.
So all three of us went to law school, so you know what a hypothetical is.
Yeah.
Let's assume November of 2022, you are the new member of the Board of Supervisors for the western side of the county. What do you think you can do that will address this? I mean, as a member of the Board of Supervisors for the west side of LA County.
Just because you brought up law school and a hypothetical, I want you to know that I was the kid who hid in the back of the classroom.
And, I could tell.
Covered my head
that.
So I wouldn't be called.
Me too. Me too.
But one thing, I mean, there's a number of things that I'd like to get more engaged on. Number one is something that I have not done enough work on, but that the county has a very, very big footprint on, and that is mental health. Our mental health services, not just in the county of Los Angeles, but throughout the state of California, are not what they should be, to put it mildly. We need more resources. We need more mental health professionals. And this is particularly true if I'm successful, as I hope I will be, in becoming elected to the Board of Supervisors. I will be coming into office just as we are coming out of the pandemic. The pandemic, we talked about it earlier very briefly, Mariam, is affecting families. It is affecting children in a big way. Everyone is predicting a tsunami of mental health issues coming out of COVID. So this is something I know the current board is going to prioritize. I want to be part of that and play a strong leadership role.
And hypothetically, if you do win this, when will you be taking your oath of supervisorial office?
That would be December of 22.
Not too far away. Yeah, you're right. We will be recovering from the pandemic. And I agree with you. From children on to adults, there will be a mental health impact.
Yep.
That's an important one.
Yeah, the primary is only 15 months away. That's my timeline.
Okay, so when we first met when you were running in 2011 or 12, whenever that was, what in these 9 years you've been in office, what is there about the state legislature that people who are not in it, like myself, don't know but should know? The inner workings. So what is it? I mean, I read what's in the paper. I read what I hear on the news. But what are the things that just are hidden that we wouldn't know about that you now know about?
You know, we tend to think of people who engage in politics like myself, politicians, in a very negative light. My mom, who passed away a couple of years ago at the age of 103, the subject of politics would come up in a crowd, she would very loudly proclaim, they're all a bunch of crooks. And I would say, Mom, no, I'm like right here. She would say, oh, except for you, Richard. But the group of people that I work with, people who I agree with, people who I disagree with rare exception, are people who care about their communities, people who care about improving conditions in California, and think about issues not just as they should about their local communities, but also about how the things we work on affect everyone in the state. And I don't think most people again, you know, it's what gets reported and, you know, controversy, and it's kind of human nature to think negatively about leaders. But, you know, I would want people to know that, generally speaking, you got a hardworking, good group of people in Sacramento who have the best interests of the state in mind and their local communities.
It's good to hear.
Yeah.
That and the fact that there's a lot of great live music there, and the food in Sacramento is excellent. It's the they've branded themselves the Farm and Fork Capital of America. They're close to many of our agriculture regions, and so a lot of great fresh food offerings.
I worked in Sacramento one summer when I was in college, and I was just amazed at all the parties, all the events. Of course, I was a college student, so you get invited to this thing, and there's all these hors d'oeuvres and all this food and stuff to drink, and it's all free. So I was amazed.
My least favorite part of being in elected office.
Eating?
No.
Being
just
in Sacramento?
The party circuit.
Yeah.
There does tend to be numerous parties every evening, and you know we'll run through the circuit, but you know I've made a habit of grabbing a cup of water, and I think self-preservation says don't drink at these events, Richard, and so I enjoy a glass of wine as much as the next person, but I don't drink at these events.
Well, I mean, talk about preconceived notions. Most people think Sacramento is pretty dull and boring, so you guys have just dispelled that. Thank you so much. Richard, it was a pleasure to have you on this podcast. It was really nice to get to know you. It's good to know that the spark that brought you into politics was fire, and so you'll certainly be dealing with that in the foreseeable future. So thank you for all of the effort that you put in on our behalf in Sacramento, and we look forward to calling you county supervisor.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here, and I look forward to doing it again.
Yeah, it's whenever I'm with you, I always learn a little something new, so... thanks for joining us. Thanks for being here, and good luck with your race.
Thank you.